The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
George Brockler back with you here. Hour two of four, Chuck Kirk at 10, Prager 11, Gorka at 1, and then Deb Flora back from 3 to 4. Deb's show, a great one to tune into if you haven't been doing it so far. Make a point of it. And then 4 o'clock to 7, of course, we have Stefan Tubbs always knocking it out of the park. Guy's been doing this since, I don't know, Marconi? I don't know, but he's been doing this a long time, and you can just tell when you listen, he knows what he's talking about. 303-696-1971 is our number, but there's no need to call right now because we're going right to the VIP line to talk with the dad, Josh Scharf. Dad, how are you?
Great. Not bad, George. How are you doing?
Good, my man. Hey, we have been so consumed with the local stuff these days, whether it's the battle over the safe injection sites, the exploding property values, the efforts by the legislature to provide immunity to all offenders for all crimes they might ever commit under any circumstance. But we're sort of not talking about some of the other big things that are going on globally, and you seem to know that stuff. So I'm glad you're willing to have that conversation with us today. What can you tell us about what's going on in Ukraine? Billy told me a couple stories about how Putin has had to dust off some old vintage tanks. They've had some problems with some supersonic jets. What's going on over there?
Yeah, the Russian military is demonstrating its traditional competence. And apparently there was a supersonic. There was one of their jets just like spontaneously combusted while it was doing its thing, which is, you know, always good for morale.
Was it made by Elon?
It was no. It was, now, see, that's not fair. You know,
because he had another similar incident. Maybe it was the same material.
Yeah. Yes, it was the new Russian Starship model. Yeah,
that's
no,
it.
The thing just like blew. And there's video of it. You know, if you want to go watch on YouTube, there's video of this thing flying and then just like going boom. And not a sonic boom, you know. It was pretty entertaining. Again, unless you're, you know, if you're a pilot, you're probably wondering why that happened, and you'd like to have an answer. So that's a little discouraging for them. But the other thing is another one of their pilots made a mistake apparently and bombed a town just on the wrong side of the line, Belgorod, which is used as a staging point and a depot. And if you remember in the, let's say, early stages, maybe around this time last year, maybe a little bit later, Ukraine staged a raid of some kind. It was either missiles or an airplane or something. And they bombed into, this was the place that they bombed. They bombed the military charter. Here the Russians just, unfortunately for some civilians on their side, let a bomb go on their own city. So
what?
You know, these are, yeah, you know, it's, you would think with the front being far enough away that wouldn't happen. But
was this was this General Wile E. Coyote? I mean, who's the person running the show out there?
Well, again, you know, it's unclear exactly what as in most things, the enemy isn't going to tell you exactly what happened. Who knows? I mean, it could have been a mechanical failure. It could have been, there are a number of reasons why, none of them good, why something like that might happen. But yeah, so that's also, you know, now you got Russia, you know, people look up at the sky, you know, a lot during these things, and now you got the Russians doing the same thing. The big question over there, obviously, is, you know, is about the much awaited, still awaited Ukraine spring offensive, and is this going to happen?
We're in the spring.
You know, the Russian, we are, and we're past, you know, we're more or less past mud season. So, over there. So the question is, you know, with the Russians, their sort of winter, I don't know if you would call it a winter offensive. I guess you could call it a winter offensive. Didn't really yield very much, although it, you know, sort of, they got what they typically get, which are these little incremental gains, and fighting, especially over on the eastern side. But they were sort of waiting for the Ukrainian spring offensive to see if they're able to repeat last year's surprise success. And we don't know when or where. The Ukrainians have a pretty good track record of keeping stuff quiet, so we don't know where or when that's going to happen. And we'll see if they're able to accumulate enough stuff. You know, one of the problems that we've talked about is the inability of U.S. and European arms manufacturers to keep up with the pace of
Is it coming at the expense of our ability to respond to something, I don't know, in the Taiwan area?
Possibly in two different areas, both Taiwan and Israel. Now the Israel one, there was an article in Times of Israel about how they're starting to pull. The U.S. has long had a large ammunition depot there, or a series of ammunition depots there. That stuff is there in the event that Israel faces a sort of a 1973 type event, you know, where they where they really need stuff there at the time. We can't wait for it to show up. And there is some concern that with the Saudis making nice with the Iranians, and the Iranians them having sort of worked on at least quieting down Yemen, that frees up stuff that the Iranians can use, you know, and it's created what has been reported in the Israeli press, this fear that on multiple fronts there's stuff building up here. So that's and at the same time the U.S. has decided that the Middle East isn't very important anymore, and so it's going to shift this stuff to Ukraine. And that and they're pulling arms out of these weapons caches that started under the last government over there, and it's continued up until recently under the Netanyahu government as well. So it's a matter of some concern. In terms of Taiwan, I think we should remember that the stuff that you're going to use to defend Taiwan is probably a little different from the stuff you're going to use to defend Ukraine. But the overall inability to replace the losses is concerning. And so while you may not need, you know, the stuff that you're sending Ukraine may not be the kinds of missiles or the kinds of munitions that you would need to defend Taiwan, you have to be a little worried about the ability to replace the losses over there if something happens.
Josh, one of the other things that doesn't get reported on much by the mainstream folks but is out there is Putin has started depopulating the occupied areas of Ukraine and starting to ship out Ukrainians to Russia and move Russians into those occupied territories. My guess is trying to make it very, very difficult to take back those spaces and to win the argument that, hey, you have taken over Ukrainian territory. I mean, he seems to be pushing that cultural shift ongoing while he's fighting these battles.
Yeah, one of the things the Russians have had to deal with is the fact that they expected the Ukrainian population, and by that I mean Ukrainian nationals who maybe spoke Russian, to be much more receptive to their invasion, and that hasn't happened. And so, you're right. I mean, this is those people have been causing all kinds of mischief behind Russian lines. Blowing things up, but, you know, making it difficult to move, you know, to move stuff around. And so, you know, if he does this, obviously this is, you know, not that he particularly cares, and we should take note of that. That obviously is a violation of international law to do stuff like that. The Geneva Conventions are quite clear about that. But, you know, listen, I mean, international law is only as good as the ability of the people who signed on to it to enforce it. And so, you know, if you're not able to enforce it, then that doesn't mean anything. And when people ask, well, you know, why should I care about Taiwan? Why does it matter if China, you know, becomes the big gorilla in the Western Pacific? That's why. Because the ability to enforce international law is the only thing that keeps it in place.
Yeah, that matters. That matters. We're talking with Josh Sharp from the Independence Institute. The kind of big revelation that's taken place over the last however many weeks is that despite the statements to the contrary, it looks like Americans have boots on the ground in Ukraine. True, and to what extent?
I don't know. I honestly don't know.
Where
I mean,
are your troops, and may we count them? No, that's from the...
Yeah, right, exactly. Yeah, right, right. But, listen, it's, you know, it's possible. It would be really embarrassing if something, if, you know, there were to be a strike and, you know, there would turn out to be some dead Americans when they were promised not, you know, I'm sure that this is being done, you know, out of uniform, or it's being done in some other, you know, that they're doing something to try and mask it. But, you know, when guys don't come home, guys don't come home.
I figure it's SF guys, or maybe it's some systems dudes or something that are helping. Because I feel like they're probably getting trained somewhere else, Poland or somewhere else. But on the ground, I don't know. I mean, it's just spooky to think that we're that we have special forces guys on the ground. I mean, have you heard that?
I had not.
Interesting. Interesting. That had been floating around a bit. No, I get that. So when we look at this thing, what's the next phase of this? Is this going to be like their Vietnam part two? Is this Afghanistan for the Russians again? The Ukrainians just keep fighting, and every couple months we revisit, hey, what's going on in Ukraine? How does it end?
That's a good question. I don't know. I mean, if the Russians really are still absolutely bound and determined to reabsorb all of Ukraine, then, you know, then it goes on until Ukraine collapses. Like I said, one of the limiting factors here. And when all these documents got released, you know, we have the fellow who released all these
on Discord, social media.
Yeah, one of the documents that was sort of most important there was the claim that the Ukrainian missile defenses were running low on ammunition. And if that's true, that sort of makes it hard to launch your offensive.
Right.
If you can't protect those troops, you know, and if you can't protect the supply lines leading to them. So that's kind of a problem, if it's true. And so, listen, I mean, it just goes on. I guess it goes on until one side collapses. You know, the Russians also have been, you know, have also had a problem. They're having to rely on Iranian drones, which is which would be amusing if it weren't, you know, if the things didn't still kill people. And and they've also had to pull out. Their tank production has been minimal. Has not kept up with what they have said they need, and will still not keep up with what they said they need. Now they're pulling old models out of mothballs and sort of trying to upgrade them a little bit. But they're also going into their stocks, and this could just end up being a war of not necessarily manpower attrition, but supply attrition.
That's interesting.
And whoever runs out first loses.
Well, the resolve piece, I think, as long as Putin's in power, I think we know theirs. I think the New York Times reported less than 0% chance this guy stops what he's doing at the current pace. I just wonder if the rest of Europe and America will continue to support Ukraine moving forward. I was going to ask you about China and Taiwan. I'm happy to do that, Josh, but I kind of wanted to shift into currency. And I've read a few more stories about how there are more and more countries out there that are looking to or even making efforts to break away from the dollar as the go-to currency. We've really relied upon that for some great stability and strength and influence across the globe. But a lot of that flowed from, I think, oil and gas being traded in that monetary amount. What's going on out there? Is there anything to be worried about, or is this much ado about nothing?
Yeah, this is one of those things where, you know, things sort of happen slowly and then happen all at once. And we've had shifts in currency, you know, what the lead currency is before, and it's never good and it's never painless. We have absolutely 100%, especially over the last couple of years, abused our position as the reserve currency by just, you know, printing as much of it as we like. And that's, you know, you want to know where inflation is coming from, that's where inflation is coming from. And so there's it's hard to tell, but China has every interest in talking up discontent with the dollar and trying to, because obviously what underpins any of this, whenever you have, even, you know, listen, even, you know, even currency that's backed by gold is vulnerable. As, you know, we saw before we went off the gold standard, you still had panics. You know, you still had situations where people would lose confidence in an economy or lose confidence in a bank or lose, you know, and money would flow out. And then you have, you know, Friedman, you know, our buddy Milton Friedman in Free to Choose has a marvelous chapter about what happens then. So it's, you know, what happened in the Great Depression and the monetary issues that built up there. And this was while we were still on the gold standard. But so it's not just a function of having fiat currency, but being able to print whatever you like certainly makes it worse when countries say, well, you know, what is this actually worth anything? And are we, you know, and is the U.S. going to be able to make good on these debts? Is there, you know, and this goes to the debt limit stuff. If you invite a crisis of confidence, then over long enough, then eventually you will get a crisis of confidence. And so, yeah, I mean, I don't think it's the kind of thing we have to worry about tomorrow, but it's the kind of thing that over a period of time can really, you know, would be tremendously destructive. It would absolutely impair our ability to fight, but more importantly, it would wreak havoc on our economy if there were to be a sudden major shift away from the dollar.
And do you see a sudden shift? I mean, can there be, and where would they go? If they shift away from us, they're going to the yen. I mean, what is it, yen, 3% or 4% of the world currency at this point?
Yeah, that's the problem. Is there's not, for them, that's the point, is that there's no plausible alternative. The Chinese, by the nature of what they have built up, can't make their currency completely convertible because they don't want to lose that kind of control. So the yuan is not a plausible alternative. You know, listen, I mean, they could go. You could conceivably go to a basket of currencies. That as an interim step, that's been done before. You go to a basket of currencies, and then that becomes the reserve. I don't know how you make that shift, but an increasing percentage of the world trade is just not happening in dollars, and we need to be aware of that. As I say, it's not something that's going to happen tomorrow, but you know, it will happen slowly and then all at once.
You know, Josh, I did not, and I don't think anyone did, ever talked about the fact that a very loose policy of just printing more and more money during the COVID and all this could have the potential longer-term international ramifications that it might be, based on what you said. That was never part of the conversation that I'm aware of, and yet here we are dealing with it. Is there a fix for this?
Not a painless one. The only fix for it is to, you have to continue. Powell is you know, coming in for a lot of abuse, but ultimately he is right. The point of raising interest rates, the point of the Fed tightening money is not, people say, well, it's to cause a recession, which was, no, it's not. That may be a side effect, but the point of it is not to cause a recession. The point of it is to try to soak up some of those excess dollars. We were able to get away with a lot of that printing because during the crisis, during that economic crisis that the response to COVID created, there appeared to be this insatiable appetite for dollars worldwide because it was seen as a safe place. And so we could print and people would use and would take. And there wasn't a problem. Well, those are now starting to come home now. And I think also, there's a, you know, we have for a long time, and even after the COVID crisis is over, then we go and we decide we're going to do this, you know, the Build Back Better or whatever is, you know, which is another few trillion dollars you're just dumping out onto the market. If you continue, what we have done is we have continued to put money out, put dollars out without a corresponding increase in production. So that's what causes inflation. We have substituted for a long time, dollars for production, and now we are, you know, now and then the last couple of years we just absolutely floored that, you know, just put the pedal and there we are. I mean, so that's why you're seeing this. That's why you're seeing this inflation. The only way out is to raise interest rates and try to suck.
Stop, bite your tongue, man. The Fed's going to meet here and make a decision. I hope that they decide to go flat, but I think they're going another quarter point up. I don't want to get into that with you because, man, we'll end up talking about this for another 30 minutes, and I want to cut you loose to go do the other great work that you do for the Independence Institute and for your family. Josh Scharf, we'll have you back on again. You never cease to amaze me with the amount of information you have. Thanks for taking time out to share it with us.
Thank you. I hope that's a good thing.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Thank you very much, George.
Yeah, listen, if it was just me asking questions and you said, I don't know, I mean, then that would be a much shorter interview, but you always seem to know, so thank you.
All right. Very good. You have a good day, and
you
thanks
too.
So much.
That's Josh Scharf with the Independence Institute. You can check out his work there, Complete Colorado. He does some great work there as well. Hey, we're going to cut away for a break. We're going to come back and be joined by former district attorney from Denver. His name is Mitch Morrissey. He has helped author a report that puts a dollar amount and the economic impact on Colorado's number one ranking as the stolen vehicle capital of America. When we come back, George Brockman on The George Show, 710 KNUS. Our next guest is a small town girl living in a lonely world. We've had him on before. We'll continue to have him on as long as he's willing to sacrifice whatever remaining credibility he has. It's former Denver District Attorney Mitch Morrissey. Mitch, thanks for joining us on 710.
Hey, good morning, George, and congratulations on your award. I saw Westward selected you.
Yeah, crazy, isn't it?
In town. Hey, no, I think that's great, man. You're knocking it out of the park. And I heard your last guest, and I understand why.
Oh, thank you for saying that. Now, let's just continue with that same awesome performance here. We've had you on a bunch of times before to talk about criminal justice stuff, but because you are one of the Norm Early Bill Owens Fellows at the Common Sense Institute, and as you know well, Mitch, they only pick the smartest, best-looking people to fill those spots, you have been busy, and you and the CSI folks have put together yet another report that tries to, I think, bring home to Coloradans the pocketbook impact of all the stolen vehicles, beyond just the aggregate, hey, this many millions and billions of dollars has been stolen. There was a real deep dive here in this latest updated report to try to talk about some other impacts based on that. Tell us about that.
Well, George, you know, Dr. Stephen Byers and Cole Anderson, the two that help us really do these deep dives at CSI, did another incredible job here. They got a hold of what we are paying as far as insurance goes for auto insurance. And really, the focus was how, you know, across the board, the state of Colorado, people, what is it costing us per household, per person, to have this incredibly high auto theft rate? You know, for 3 years running, Colorado's been number one in the nation when it comes to auto theft. We talked about how much those cars are. We talked about the 15,000 cars stolen in Denver alone in 2022. I think it was you that came up with the analogy to the parking lots at a home Bronco game. We could fill all those parking lots with cars that were stolen just in Denver in 2022, three times over. So it continues to be a major problem. We got a hold of this auto theft insurance rates, compared them then with 2014, where really this trend started when the legislature chose by policy to impact auto theft by basically decriminalizing an awful lot of it. And we saw a big spike, increase in auto thefts there, and it almost in 2019, then it started to soar. And we've started to see these number one rates that we have across the country.
Mitch Morrissey from Common Sense Institute. And you can check out the report at commonsenseinstituteco.org. I would love to take credit for that analogy to the parking lot thing, but honest to goodness, man, it was the super smart nerdy dudes at CSI that came up with that all by themselves. I think they were channeling us. But they came up with that. When I look at this graph, and you just talked about it, if you look at the graph that CSI has produced here that looks at the motor vehicle theft crime rate that has taken place in Colorado, it is so stark. When you get to 2014 and we change the law, it just surges. It plateaus for a couple years, and then right about 2019, it just explodes like it is a rocket taking off. One of the other things that took place during that time is we sort of doubled down on being weak on motor vehicle theft. We changed the classification of charges for motor vehicle theft.
Yeah, we changed them drastically in 2014, then changed them again around 2020. And there is almost a straight up, it almost goes straight up from about 2019 to 2022. And that's what landed us in the problem that we're in. But the difference in this report is that we used the REMI model, which models policies, and we're able to do that with the Colorado economy and come up with the impact that it's having across the board in the state. So maybe your car hasn't been stolen and you haven't had to try to recover it and do the kinds of things, go down to the pound and get it and all of, you know, pay for the damage or pass that on to your insurance company. Maybe you haven't been the victim of this, but you really have. If you look at these numbers, you look at what it's costing us as far as jobs in the state, reduction in personal income, reduction in the state GDP, all of those things are impacted by the fact that insurance rates have soared along with auto thefts because they've had to keep paying. And that's part of the issue and part of what we're trying to uncover in this report.
Yeah, Mitch, the numbers associated with the things you talked about are not throwaway numbers. I mean, the fewer jobs thing that this REMI model generates, 1,530 fewer jobs. I mean, it's craziness. $101 million lost in personal income across the state. $158 million in lost state gross domestic product, GDP. An 11% increase in inflation. How about this? $240-ish per household just to accommodate the outcome of these very, very lax and weak auto theft policies that we've adopted. Listen, you can say it's just mere coincidence. I can't, man. If you look at this graph and these numbers and the timing of some of these legislative changes, what is the other explanation? If it's not what we've done to the law, what is the other explanation for us becoming number one in the country?
And the telltale sign of that, George, is if you look at the very graph you were talking about, because we went back to 2008, and you see the number. You have the expected motor vehicle theft rate, and then you see the real rate, and it dances around that expected rate. It goes below it sometimes. It goes above it sometimes. But it doesn't vary much at all for that period from 08 to 2014. And then, boom, it just explodes. And then as that law went into effect, see, I think the problem with our legislature and our policymakers, they don't understand that these criminals pay attention to what they're doing. When they change the law, they take advantage of those changes. If it means they need a car, they're stealing cars, it's a car ring, hey, if you get caught, you want to have this value car because it's going to be a misdemeanor. In other words, it's a joke. And so you can steal four or five cars a night, but make sure you don't steal those cars that put you in the felony range. That's the opportunity that the legislature gave the criminals in 2014. And you can see between 2014 and 2022, they've taken full advantage of it. And it has cost the citizens of Colorado quite a bit.
Yeah, the criminals aren't book smart. Like, they couldn't tell you the statutory change or all that. But what they know is what they experience. And what they experience is no consequences. Like, they're not going to jail. Even after being convicted, they're not going to jail. And so they just continue on. These numbers, if you look at just 2018... the motor vehicle theft rate, 397.4, it more than doubles just between then and 2022, and we're up to 801.2. It's insane how much motor vehicle theft has exploded in Colorado. And right now, there's a bill in the legislature that would do a teeny tiny but well-needed tinkering of the law. In fact, Mitch, you went and testified in favor of it, got it out of the Senate, but it seems to have stalled somewhere in the House. Tell us about that bill.
Well, every bill has a fiscal note, and that's really the impact on what will it cost if you spend any of the auto thieves to the penitentiary. Very few of them are going to be there. Real professionals, and they have an incredible criminal history. Judges do everything they can in their power to not use those beds in the penitentiary for these kinds of criminals, and it's to a certain degree that makes sense. But what this law does, the one that came out of the Senate, and I don't know if it bogged down because of the fiscal note, but remember, that's what this report is about, George. It talks about the real cost of real citizens in Colorado. And those legislators should say, okay, it's going to increase the state budget a little bit, but it's not going to be bigger than this. It's not going to be bigger than what it costs the people of the state of Colorado. And they need to take that into effect. So today, it's up in the House. I hear there are some fierce people opposing it, and I don't know why.
I don't get it.
Is there? I mean, when you see this kind of evidence, and we've been presenting this evidence for what, 3 years now, 2 years now.
Yeah.
But what it really does is it levels the playing field when it comes to auto theft. It stops this idea that if you steal my Lexus or George your Lexus, that's a class 3 felony. But you go out and you steal my 20-year-old Jeep, and it's not worth that much because it hardly runs, that's the different level. And we talked about this in the past, that sometimes people that have those cheaper cars, they need that car. They don't have a
car. More than you and I might need ours because we have other alternatives and they don't. I mean, that just it.
Right.
The other thing that I hear from you, and I experienced it sitting in on this, that feels like many times the legislature cares more about government's wallet than they do about ours. And that's what this comes down to. If they're going to choose the fiscal note over the positive impact of holding people accountable for stealing our cars, once again, a complete disconnect between the community and us. Mitch, forgive me, I got to let you go, man, but you've done a great job. You've crushed this segment as always. Folks can go to commonsenseinstituteco.org and check out that report. And Mitch, I presume you and I aren't done with this.
No, George, we're going to keep after them until they start to do some common sense things, kind of like the Institute is named. I'm just, it's a great pleasure to be a fellow with you, and congratulations again on your award.
Thanks, man. Thanks. That's Mitch Morrissey. He's the former Denver DA, doing great work still in the criminal justice and public safety arena. Great to work with that guy. And you go check out that report at commonsenseinstituteco.org. When we come back, we're going to be joined by the minority leader from the House of Representatives. His name is Mike Lynch. He's going to tell us about that government-sponsored injection site bill. George Brockler, George Show, 710 KNUS. I'll be humming this song all day long. George Brockler back with you here, 710 KNUS. My thanks to Mitch Morrissey, former Denver DA and current Owens Early Fellow out there at the Common Sense Institute. That is a great report. Listen, there's other news out there, though. It's not all bad under the Gold Dome. Sometimes the good guys win. We're going to talk to one of them right now. It's Assistant Minority Leader Mike Lynch. Sir, thanks for taking time out of your drive up to the Gold Dome where you're continuing to do battle. Give us some good news. What happened yesterday?
Yeah, great news. George, by the grace of God, we, and a whole lot of work, we got 1202 defeated. I think what we're beginning to see is they're pushing this envelope. I say they, the progressive wing of the Democrat Party, is pushing the envelope as far as they can, and they push too far with safe injection sites. Not a practice that has ever proven anywhere to be effective. And we were successful in getting it defeated. So it was great. We revel in the very few victories that we get down there. But that's a big one.
How did you pull it off? Because there's no way it could just be all Republicans. What was it you think that convinced the Dems to break against the tide? And how many broke against the tide?
Well, here's the deal. The governor was not in favor of that all along. And to be honest with you, he didn't want to have to veto it, I think. So, the Democrats under the Gold Dome know that, whenever King Polis doesn't agree with something, that they should potentially follow along. And here's the other thing. They didn't swap out members. like they did last night in judiciary to try to change that vote. Last night, in judiciary in the Senate, they were hearing the bill that will raise the floor, raise the age of which kids can be prosecuted.
Oh my God! And, yeah, I'm glad you're talking about this one. This is Minority Leader Mike Lynch from the House. That one, did that go to like midnight last night? That one seemed like it was taking forever.
It was going when I left at 10. So, and then they still had a full docket. So, they had a busy night in Senate Judiciary, but they swapped out members. They knew that did not have the votes. And so, They swapped out members.
We're going to be talking with Senator Bob Gardner at the top of the hour about that. He lived it. He was right there. I can't wait to hear the insider stuff on that. First off, congratulations. A lot of texts coming in right now. People just so thankful that this government-supervised injection site bill is gone. I presume this won't be their last effort at it. As you know, they continue to push. What else is out there that we can be optimistic about as we head into the final days of this thing?
Well, there's not a lot of optimism left. I mean, the important bills that they're actively pushing back right now. One of them is the bill I'm on, which is Senate Bill 109, which increases the penalty if you're a drug dealer. We're not talking about somebody that's at a party, but if you distribute drugs to somebody and it results in their death, which happens to happen with fentanyl on the scene now,
a lot.
This increases the penalty for that. And we can't even get it to be heard in committee right now. So that's a factor of the committee chair. So Mike Weissman is blatantly pushing back, doing the right thing in trying to get a handle on our drug problem.
Why? What's the reasoning behind that? They don't want to hold anybody accountable for anything? Is it something special about drug dealers? Is there an anecdote that they refer to? Like, well, one time Timmy gave a pill to his buddy and he died. That guy shouldn't go to prison for that?
Yeah, there's all kinds of anecdotes with it that go along. But basically, we don't want to give anybody a felon. Nobody should be a felon. So we don't want to punish anybody for their actions, and so they will literally argue, for drug dealers. You have elected legislators who are arguing in the defense of drug dealers. This is what went on in the Senate, and I'm afraid they don't want to see that happen in the House. So that's why they're holding that one up, I believe.
Along those same lines, we just talked with Mitch Morrissey, the former Denver DA, and he went, I was there, I was going to testify on this bill in front of the Senate Judiciary too, and it was the one that would merely treat all stolen cars the same for purposes of making them a felony. There's some right now that are misdemeanors because they're just not as nice of cars as others. Like it's, you're in my car, not Rose Puglisi's car. So this was a bill that would elevate that to just felonies. Do you know what the status of that is? It cleared the Senate. I think it's in the House now.
I think it still hasn't been heard in committee either.
What in the world? How many days are left?
We've got we end not this Monday, but the next. So 10 days left here. So, yeah, they're really pushing it. Now, I mean, the good news is those are Senate bills. Another one that's coming up is the indecent exposure to children.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
That one has not been heard yet. And I love it. I love it when these sexual aggressors, and I just don't understand what the people of Colorado are thinking by putting these folks in office that will argue for the guy that is standing 10 foot from a 10-year-old with exposing himself. Somehow we think that it's mean for us to prosecute those people. They're sickos, and they need to be put in jail.
Well, they're a little stuck, too, because if a guy were to do it online to the exact same kid, it's a felony. Yeah. But if they do it to him in person at a park while parents are out there lunching or something, it's a misdemeanor. Yeah. It just doesn't make any sense.
Right. Well, the argument for that, George, just so you know, is that they can't help it that these families are enjoying a park where a homeless camp may be set up at the time. That's the argument. We got to give some deference to those that are living in a tent in our public spaces. I mean, this is
pantless. Apparently pantless. They can't afford pants either, just the tents.
Right.
Hey, we're going to have Lisa Frizzell on in a bit to talk about this too, but any update on any progress that the legislature has made to try to stem the tide of these exploding assessed property values and the resulting taxes?
You know, there that is the next big battle, and they're making progress on that in the Senate. We haven't seen it yet in the House, though. And all of this has to happen, you know, really, really quick. We'll be working through the weekend because they spent so much time on their ideological abortion and gun bills that now they've got to go back and try to take on real issues for the state of Colorado. So it's going to be a hellish next 10 days, but we're up for it.
Well, listen, take the victory lap while you can, even if it's a small one and it's short and it's in an enclosed place. But listen, the huge win, man, knocking down this government-supervised injection site. I don't know if anybody really appreciates what a big win that is. That is a bullet we dodged.
Yes. And, you know, what really makes a difference, George, is programs like this that get the word out. You know, I say it over and over. If we could get everybody from Highlands Ranch to just take a three-block tour around the Capitol and say, hey, guess what? This is coming to your neighborhood, we would see an overwhelming majority in the House.
It's brilliant stuff.
We can't get that message out, but there's guys like you that do it, and really appreciate it.
Well, I hope we get a chance to have you on again before the end of this thing, and certainly afterwards. It's Representative Mike Lynch. He's the minority leader out there in the House, going to do battle yet again today. Good luck, sir.
Thank you, George. Appreciate you.
Thank you. Hey, listen, that's it for this hour. But when we come back, man, the hits just keep a coming. We're going to be joined by Senator Bob Gardner, wicked smart attorney type guy who's in the Senate, in the Judiciary Committee. He's one of those guys that dealt with the shenanigans. That's what I'm going to call it. I don't know what he'll call it. The shenanigans yesterday to force that bill that provides protection for 12-year-old rapists, robbers, attempted murders, and minimizes the penalties for 13 to 17-year-olds. He's going to talk to us about that bill and what took place. Then we'll be joined by Lisa Frizzell talking about the assessed property value stuff. And at 9, we're going to talk about that weenie wagger bill. Stick around. George Brockler, 710 KNUS.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.